Okay, so glad you're back with us here at GoldSeek.com. The first interview of the new year 2015. Harry S. Dent Jr. joins me from HSDent.com. Harry S. Dent Jr., editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper, and many bestsellers. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, nice to be back, Chris.
Quite an interesting year in the markets. Seemed to catch a lot of people off guard. You know, you're one of our only guests to predict the U.S. dollar rally.
Well, no, you know, we were kind of seeing the dollar going back to its highs, which it's done. It's slightly exceeded that. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the dollar takes a little break here for a few months. But we see the dollar going higher. And we see, it's funny, like the dollar trades against all the risk on assets, everything else. It trades against other currencies. It trades against stocks and commodities. So sometime in 2015, not quite yet, the market still looks like it has upward momentum, at least for a few months. And we're still in the bubble from our point of view. And that's my biggest statement to the world, is this is a bubble. Everybody on CNBC and Wall Street saying, oh, no, it's not a bubble because of this and this and this. It's a bubble. And what people don't understand about bubbles, it does not matter what causes them, whether it's excessive stimulus and low interest rates from the government or supply, you know, insufficient supply versus demand in real estate or you know, speculation or whatever. When stocks go up like this so steeply, or real estate or anything, they're going to come down, and they're going to come down hard. Bubbles don't crack, they burst. So my forecast is that sometime in 2015, my best guess is around March, that we peak at 19,000, maybe 20,000 on the Dow, and we see the biggest crash of our lifetimes. You know, we see the Dow drop in the next few years down to 6,000 and maybe ultimately lower, but we're going to see a classic 70% plus crash, which you see after every major bubble in history. Bubbles don't crack 10 or 20% or go down slowly. They usually crash 60, 70, 80% within 2 to 3 years. I'm saying not quite yet. Stocks don't look ready to top. You know, we may see a little correction here, but it looks like to me they're going to keep going up at least for the next few months.
Well, that's certainly been one of the biggest themes here of 2014. Stocks, the place to park assets, and a lot of money, a lot of capital flows from the rest of the world looking for a place to participate in a rally, particularly with so much currency unrest outside of our shores. So you think there's going to be a flight to safety at some point in 2015?
Yeah, I mean, bubbles always defeat themselves. People always have rationales for bubbles, but any bubble goes so high that people can't afford it anymore. And people are saying stocks are not that overvalued. It's something like 18 times earnings. Well, 18 times earnings is well higher than average. And if you adjust the price earnings ratios for cyclicality, which Robert Shiller does, we're really at 27-28, which is higher than most bubble peaks and stock market peaks in history outside of 1929 and 2000, which were the largest bubbles. But, you know, they always destroy themselves. And same with real estate. I mean, New York's having its best year ever. Condos are selling for anywhere from $5,000 to $13,000 a square foot. That's ridiculous. It's going to get to the point where only rich Chinese can buy anything, and you just run out of demand. I mean, bubbles defeat themselves. So, you know, we've got a real estate bubble around the world. And many places never even took a hit like the U.S. took in 2006 to 2012. Canada kept going up. China kept going up. Mumbai's kept going up. Singapore's kept going up. Australia, you know, London, Paris, Rome are at ridiculous prices. And these are going to burst. And people think real estate can't go down because they haven't seen it go down in their lifetime. But if you study history, real estate's pretty much nearly as volatile as stocks. And the second thing people don't get about real estate that Robert Shiller, you know, basically discovered, if you adjust real estate for inflation and the size, average size of houses, it's not an appreciating asset. It doesn't go up.
Dr. Shiller took the index back 100 years or more. It has a tendency to revert to the mean.
Again, adjusted for inflation, it doesn't go up at all. It's not an appreciating asset. Real estate is more like we were taught Monopoly, that basically you buy it for the rents, or you buy it, you buy a house to avoid paying rent, you know, and get a mortgage or buy instead. But it's the income from the property. The real estate does generate income, but it does not appreciate like stocks do. Stocks, if you go back in the same time period that Shiller did and adjust for inflation, stock averaged 7% adjusted for inflation. Stocks are an appreciating asset. Real estate is not. You should buy real estate to turn out a positive cash flow or because you're going to live in it and save the rent for your investment. That's the reason you should buy it.
Okay, now keeping with the market bubble theme, things getting frothy, we also tend to see more of a very steep rise before bubbles end. Do you expect to see this equities rally start to display signs of irrational exuberance?
Well, first of all, if you track the market, especially since the only decent correction we've had since 2009 and all this stimulus was in 2011. From there on, stocks have gone up more parabolic. And I've seen people who place a theoretical bubble over the Dow or S&P, and it tracks almost exactly, and it looks very close to peaking. So it already has been parabolic, but I remind people that this is different. And if you look back in history, you usually see one great bubble like the Roaring Twenties or the 90s in tech stocks or you know, you go back in 1830s and, you know, 1860s and 70s. There'll be one big bubble and then it'll crash. We've never had a situation where governments around the world have literally decided, oh, we're not going to let the bubbles crash and we're just going to keep them going. Now we've had three bubbles. You know, the one that peaked in early 2000, the one that peaked in late 2007, and now this one. And so you can't expect, I don't compare this bubble to the 90s bubble. I don't compare the price-earnings ratio to that time, because in the 90s, and I was one of the few people that saw this, we had the strongest spending of the largest generation in history, the strongest spending pattern. On top of that, the internet was moving mainstream along with cell phones and all these new technologies, just like automobiles and electricity and phones, back in the Roaring Twenties, and we had a geopolitical environment that was hunky-dory. Nothing was wrong in the world. There was no big Middle East Arab Spring. There was no Russia rolling into Ukraine. You know, no planes weren't falling out of the skies every other week. You know, it was a whole different environment. And now we're in a very risky world, and we're in a third bubble that's been now totally artificially created. This recovery, this bubble would not have happened without $14 trillion of money being pulled out of the thin air by every central bank in the world, if you put them all together, you know, $4 trillion just from us. This wouldn't have happened. So to me, this is actually a worse bubble. No, the valuations are not quite as high as in early 2000, but this bubble has nothing under it except for stimulus. I mean, the bubble of the 90s had the strongest economy in U.S. history and in world history, and the fundamentals supported that. And then that's what most bubbles do. You get a really good economy with falling interest rates, and then people just go nuts and start at some point buying stocks and real estate and things just because they're going up, and they lose the fundamentals, and then you get that frothy thing you're talking about. The best chart I have, Chris, is just plotting the S&P 500 in a channel since 2011, and it's following that channel. We're on the upper end of that channel, so I don't think there's a lot of potential. To me, there's two scenarios here. Either we keep edging up over the next few months, and that would give us a Dow about 19,000 and an S&P about 2175, and stay within this channel on the top side and then collapse at some point. Or we break above this channel, and you do get a very frothy thing, and next thing you know, we're 20,000 Dow in March. I am looking, our cyclical work suggests that we're going to get a peak in 2015. Mid-March is the most likely time. So I'm looking at two scenarios, a Dow 19,000 by then, or if we get really frothy, 20,000. Either way, if that happens, I'm very likely to be telling people, okay, get out of the stock market. We're already telling people get out of real estate because real estate is harder to get out of, gets very illiquid. And I see another real estate crash larger than the one we saw last time around and more global. It's going to happen almost everywhere.
I don't think it really takes an advanced degree in history or economics to recognize some commonalities that occur at market zeniths. Every market bubble tends to lead to another bubble. We've seen this over and over again. You could say there's some government complicity, but for the most part, we've seen those capital flows shift somewhere else. Where do you see the next bubble? Because if you're talking about a bubble in equities, more than likely, you've got your eye on another market or two where much of the money will flow.
Well, you know, Chris, I don't see another bubble. And I'll tell you what, that has been our theme now for over a decade. That what we're just seeing is one bubble after the next. We've had three stock bubbles now. You know, we've had a real estate bubble that's gone down. Now we've got a mini bubble. We saw commodities bubble across the board, one after the next. And gold was the last to peak. And the CRB peaked back in 2008. But gold didn't peak until late 2011. So we've seen one bubble after next. We've seen a bond bubble. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago you'd see a 10-year treasury at 1.38%, which we saw a few years ago, or Japanese today at 0.4% and German bonds as low as 0.7%. I mean, that is below inflation rates. That is negative return. So that's a bubble. But what at some point, when the government can no longer support this thing, or they blow it up so far that it just blows up, then the bubble's in, because money gets destroyed very rapidly, and debts, when debts fail, money gets destroyed. When financial assets fall 60, 70, 80, 90%, money disappears. And the last time that happened, the government just said, well, okay, trillions of dollars disappeared in net worth, and well, we'll just throw it back in. And that's what they did. But they've only blown up a bigger bubble. I've been saying for a long time now, the danger from central banks and the Fed creating money out of nothing is not inflation, because they're fighting deflation. The danger is they create a bigger bubble that bursts, and when the bubble bursts, the whole thing blows up and people lose confidence in the system and the Fed. I mean, last time the Fed stepped in and printed all this money. Well, this time, how are they going to come in? If we have another collapse in markets and the economy, how are they going to come in and say, well, we're going to do what we did last time, create more money? I think people will say, no, it didn't work.
Okay, but let's take the opposite side of that coin for a moment. They've been quite creative in their machinations, I think you'd agree. And for instance, they have a tendency to come up with interesting new names, new policies that very few folks have heard of before. Of course, it's really just the same game with a different moniker attached to it, but they've already systematically monetized most of the outstanding mortgage debt, what's going to stop them from simply monetizing all the bad debts and wiping away much of this deflation that you see?
Well, what's going to stop them is we get another financial crisis, because they have blown up bubbles. When you make money free or negative returns, it's always going to go into speculation, and we've seen speculation everything. Let me give you a scenario, and I think the market's totally missing this right here with all this bubble mania, and it is the only place money can go, so people rationally. We just had oil prices fall from $106 to $53 in 6 months, and that was after it fell in 4.5 months from $147 to $32 last time around. It's going to fall further. What happens when the fracking bubble bursts? And it's that fracking's done. It's over. It's not a wonder new technology that's going to create a new industry in the U.S. Only abnormally high oil prices and free money allow these frackers to be profitable, and only at, you know, between $55 and $90 prices. They're not low-cost producers. They are high-cost producers. Now that oil has fallen, and it will fall further because these frackers may be unprofitable now, which means they're not going to be able to pay back their debts, a lot of junk bonds, and they're 20% of the junk bond market. That bubble's going to burst. And oil keeps falling, and the market's like, well, it's good for the economy. It's good for consumers, but it's not good. It's going to knock out one of the growth industries of the last several years in this bubble, the whole fracking on oil and natural gas business. It's just going to be knocked out. Nobody's going to invest in this. There's going to be no more jobs day to day. Texas is almost guaranteed to go into a major recession like they did in the 1980s when the rest of the country was booming. That's oil prices crashed then. That starts a bubble. You know, and there's $500 trillion in leveraged and junk bond debt there. The next bubble to burst, the U.S., through bonds and bank lending, U.S. dollar loans to emerging country companies who are getting killed by falling commodity prices. We've been predicting for years commodity prices would burst. And their burst, this kills emerging countries and their best industries. That debt is going to blow up. And with the U.S. dollar going up, which we also predicted and have been predicting, it gets harder and harder to pay back those debts. That's $5.7 trillion. There's another debt bubble that blows. And then blah, 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 then the economy slows and real estate goes down. And then you got these. All it takes is something to trigger these bubbles, these debt bubbles burst. So all it took was a subprime crisis in four states last time. That's all it took to cause an entire global collapse.
No, exactly. California and Florida leading the pack there. It's quite an ominous scenario, but we've heard this mantra for decades. You know, there's always a bull market somewhere. It sounds to me like the only bull market you're forecasting once again is cash.
It is cash. Now, this is another thing, Chris, that people don't understand. In the 1970s, we had a big inflation global crisis. Well, there was a bull market in emerging countries, in commodities, in gold, and Japan was doing well in an off-cycle Democrat. There were plenty of places you could have made money. In the 1930s, when we had a deflationary bust, there was no place to go. Utilities went down. Casinos went down. Stocks, large cap, small cap, high dividend, low dividend, real estate, commodities, everything went down. People don't understand that. If you don't understand history and if you don't understand that there's four seasons of our economy and once in a lifetime, you're going to get a bubble burst, a deflationary, debt deleveraging, financial speculation deleveraging crisis. In that crisis, there is no real bull market with the exception of cash and the highest quality bonds.
But let's look back then, circa 2008-2009, even earlier, a somewhat similar scenario that you're outlining here. There was nowhere to hide.
Commodities, real estate, large cap, small cap, U.S., Europe, emerging country stocks, everything went down except the U.S. dollar in high-quality bonds in Germany.
But I would argue that the yellow metal held up remarkably well. There was only really a one-month dip.
I better than stocks did.
And that leads me to the next point here. If we do see some type of meltdown, as you're outlining, and this could run a little longer, the equities rally might surprise people on the upside. That's what bubbles tend to do.
That's what they do.
That just brings in the poor last individual. In that scenario, people have to start thinking a bit more defensively. My guess is you would like to see portfolios rebalancing in 2015.
Short-term treasuries are fine. I think long-term treasuries for a short period of time will spike up. People would even question that safe haven. But if one of the things we're looking for investors, if the 10-year U.S. Treasury goes to the top of a kind of declining channel we've charted now since 1989, about 3.5 to 3.7% return, we would tell people to buy those bonds, lock in those yields, because I think you're going to see yields ultimately in a deflationary period, even lower than we saw at 1.38%. I mean, the U.S. Treasury could go under 1% years from now. So, but I wouldn't buy the bonds now. We're in the middle of that channel at 2.2% roughly. The low point was 1.38. The high was a little over 3. I'd want to see yields get higher. Then I would buy bonds. That is one place I would buy highest quality. And then I would buy the longest-term Treasury. I'd buy the 30-year and lock in, you know, maybe a 4.5% yield, and then watch that thing drop back to 2% or lower, and then the 10-year drop to 1% or lower. You'd get good income, better than dividends on stocks, and you'd get appreciation while stocks and real estate and everything else goes down.
All right. Well, every complex system has its tipping point. The stock market certainly has many of the characteristics of a chaotic system. What is the focal point that you're watching for? Are you expecting the Fed to eventually have to pull the trigger on rates?
The Fed is not going to raise rates because the economy is going to suck so bad they're not going to be able to. Our demographics, the only trends that saw the fall of Japan in the late 80s before it happened and the boom in the 90s in the U.S. and Europe and the world, says Europe's going to get weaker, especially Germany, in the next year. The U.S., the only people still spending, the top 10 to 20% of affluent people, they're going to weaken demographically. The biggest thing I'm watching, though, to trigger, I'm watching the price of oil. I think the price of oil within 2015, before the end of 2015, and probably sooner, is going to go back to $32, and then the fracking industry is clearly dead. People are still hoping, oh, this is temporary in oil, and we'll be back at 80 to 100 in no time. We're not going back above 80. That's our forecast, and I don't think we'll get that high, but that's the highest I see. Oil broke down, just like gold and other major commodities, out of a long, multi-channel. When it does that, you're going to fall as much as that channel, and you're not likely to go back into that channel again for a long time. So oil's not coming back, but when it hits $30-$40, people are going to realize, oh, this whole fracking industry is dead. It's not just dead for a few years, it's dead for a long time, if not forever.
Quite a dichotomy. On the one hand, sure, it will injure the heartland of the United States, which has had a boom period here of the last decade. Yeah, thanks to fracking, as you say. But on the other hand, lower energy prices tends to boost corporate profits and bottom lines.
Chris, all we got to do, I keep telling people, look back at history. Oil went from 147 to $32 in 2008, and we were in a recession for a year after that. Oh, ultimately, it may have helped, but when prices fall that dramatically, it's showing how weak the economy is, number one. It's showing bubble bursting, number two, and overcapacity. And it's not a good thing in the short term to fall that. It's different if oil went from $100 to 80 slowly and then 80 maybe down to 70. Yeah, that's good. But a crash like this, last time around, the bubble in debt was not in high-yield bonds. It was in subprime mortgage. So this time, the bubble has been in high-yield bonds. It's going to burst the high-yield bubble. That's going to cause high-yield interest rates for corporate bonds and emerging countries who pay even higher to skyrocket. They've already jumped from 5 to 7% in a short period of time, and the bonds on fracking companies and energy companies have jumped 0.5% to 10%. But what happens if it's 15 or 20? None of these companies can borrow anymore. The debt market collapses, and that's how this trigger gets rolling. And the more debt goes bad, the more bondholders take a scrutiny to all debt and raise interest rates. That's how even the 10-year Treasury could get to 3.5%. High-yield bonds, last time we had a crisis, they went from 7.5% to 23.5%. Well, this time they could go from 5% to 25% to 30%. That's how you get a debt crisis.
So then again, what should investors be watching as a trigger point? Would you then want to see the primary theme in the major equities, U.S. equities markets, to roll over? Would that be the ultimate sell signal here?
They may take some little corrections, but I think they're going to keep edging up. If they keep edging up into March, that's one thing I'm looking for. That's going to be a danger signal. Better than that, what I'm expecting to happen is oil to find a bottom here temporarily, maybe around $49-$50, and then to rally back towards the kind of 70s where it kind of broke out dramatically. If oil, a few months, and gets back somewhere between like 64 and 76, let's call it, if it gets back in that range and then starts to fall again near term in the next several months, oil has another major leg down. This does not look like a bottom, not on the chart patterns, not any point of view, and there's only one support level for oil below this kind of $75 to $80 range that it broke after many years, and that's $32, the 2008 low. And so oil starts to fall again, it's going to crash again, and that's when the reality about the high-yield bond market and the whole fracking and energy industries is going to hit, and that's what triggers the collapse. And the Fed can't do anything about that.
But, you know, during the 2008 crisis, oil really coincided. It was more of a coincidental indicator with the equities market. This time, equities are holding up well.
Well, that's another difference we have this time. The Fed, central banks, especially here in the United States, have created an environment with super low, cheap, everything else. Commodities have been falling overall in the last several years. Bonds have been sideways. Real estate's recovered, but timidly in most places. There's been no, stocks are the only game. Fed, the central banks have made it so you've got to go into stocks, especially high dividend stocks you use. So stocks are the last bubble. They're the only place left to go. And that's why stocks are doing well. But look at, I mean, stocks. Oil is crashing. Nothing could be more obvious than these fracking companies, they've created over 1 million jobs. Texas has been the strongest state in the country. Now it's going to be the weakest. How can people ignore that these companies are not going to be able to pay back their debt in these junk bonds, and that this is the next subprime crisis? And we got to remember, in 2008, even Bernanke, everybody said, oh, the subprime thing, it's no big deal, and the banks can handle it. It's no big deal. It's no big deal. Four states triggered a global crisis, and nobody saw it coming except for a few people. The markets are ignoring this extremely obvious high-yield bond and fracking bubble, and it's going to burst, and fracking was BS from the beginning.
Now, when the whole edifice implodes, as you clearly see sometime in 2015, what emerges? What's the, you know, the market du jour at that point?
Well, basically, it's a reset. And this is good. I mean, we had the last reset, big reset we had was 1930 to 33. And it's the biggest crash in U.S. history. But from there, real estate bottomed forever and only went up. Stocks bottomed forever and only went up. The economy recovered, a few recessions here and there. But we did nothing but boom after that. It clears the debts. When you eliminate a lot of debt from the economy, and when financial assets come down and become more affordable, including real estate and housing, which is the biggest cost that families have, it's a good long-term thing.
John and Jane Q. Public are going to really get caught between the vice.
I'll tell you, Chris, who's going to get caught. And I'm just doing an article for this in my newsletter. Income inequality. 0.01% have done better than the top. 0.1% have done way better than the top. 1% have done way better than the top. 10% on and down. Negative income gains when you adjust it for inflation all the way back to, I don't know, 1970 or 1980 or something. I mean, the rich have been getting richer, and when this bubble bursts, since the rich own, the top 10% own 85% of the wealth in this country, 85% to just 10%, these people are going to get annihilated more. It was the rich that got hit the hardest in the 1930s, and after that, the middle class actually started to rise from that great reset. So I'm telling people, it's the people, yes, this, people are going to lose jobs, houses are going to go underwater again, foreclosures, all this sort of stuff, but this is going to be a marginal loss for those people. The richest people in the world are going to lose their assets at the fastest rate since the 1930s. And you're going to see, you know, billionaires go down to millionaires, that sort of thing.
You notice that the cash deals in housing comprised most of the purchases in the past few years. That's emblematic of institutions buying up with their huge assets, compliments of the U.S. Fed.
There's no place to go. Stocks. And like you say, buying real estate for cash and foreclosures and turning it around and renting it because it's not so easy to sell it. That's going to end. I mean, that's another little bubble, you know, and people are thinking real estate's going to come back stronger than ever. I've done extensive, and I mean extensive research on real estate, and I am telling people unequivocally, real estate will never be the same in our lifetime. Never, ever, ever. And you look at Japan, they're now down for the 23rd year on the bottom. 23 years. Why? Because there's more old people dying than young people buying. The net demand for real estate, because of the fact that the millennial generation in most countries, wealthy countries in the world, is not as large as the baby boomers, you're going to get this thing where, because real estate's different from other assets, it never ends. It lasts forever. So when old people die, they become sellers. And when there's more sellers than buyers, there's no demand for real estate. Real estate's not going to come roaring back, and people who are speculating in it, you should be buying real estate, as I said earlier, to rent it out. If you can buy real estate in foreclosure, like a 2-3-bedroom house, and rent it out for 5-10% positive cash flow, that's a good investment. But if you're buying it because you think it's going to come roaring back, you're going to be disappointed. My mother used to invest and run, you know, condos. She had 6 or 7 condos. She said she would never do that again. Ever, ever. It's such a pain.
Though I know you keep an eye on the charts and the technical analysis here on housing, you know, it's been sideways for 2 years. We've had no positive growth.
It has been slowing, and people are not noticing that. Real estate is not going to lead us down this time like it did last time. It's going to be more this fracking bubble and high-yield bond. But when the economy slows, of course, real estate's going to go down again. And one of the things we look at bubbles, and it's one of these universal principles, like bubbles always burst, and they always go higher than the last bubble and all this sort of stuff, but bubbles, 95% of the time, when bubbles burst, they go back to where they became bubbles. You know, not back to the last low 20 years ago or something, but where it got bubbly. And in real estate bubble, by my calculation started in January of 2000. Just to January of 2000, not way back to the 1950s or 60s or early 80s, real estate would have to fall 40-some percent from here.
Well, you know, Dr. Schill is certainly on board with you. He has been right, at least on his longer-term outlook now for over a decade and a half. What you're rolling out here is a pretty frightening concept, because what that implies, this is the largest component, you could argue, of remaining economy.
It is. And like you say, for the average person, they have more net worth in their house doing stocks. So that for the typical rich person, they have much more in financial assets like stocks and bonds and commodities and stuff. But yes, and this is something you live in, you can be foreclosed on, you've got debt against. A housing crash historically is much worse than a stock crash. Can a stock crash, well, disappears overnight and a lot of people get hit hard, but it's the wealthy that hold all these stocks. A housing crash hits everybody, and it's very deep, and we've seen how hard it was to recover from the last one. Well, this one's going to be worse by my estimate.
Corporate buybacks tends to coincide with stronger equities markets, as, you know, the big companies, they reduce their float outstanding. Basic supply and demand tends to lead to higher prices.
Yeah, it's like the fracking. It's another bubble. How did these buybacks happen so easily? Because the Federal Reserve has given money away for free. Short-term rates are zero. Long-term rates are at or above inflation, which means zero. Money is free. When money's free and companies aren't growing, I just saw a thing the other day. IBM sales, I don't know, 5-10% lower than they were 5 or 6 years ago, yet the stock is way higher. Why? Buybacks. Companies are buying back their own stocks with very cheap money, and they're not investing in the future because they don't see the growth, and they say, well, hey, how do we help our shareholders? We buy back our own stock. That's artificial, and it's only made if they had to pay, you know, 6% for that money instead of 2% or something, that wouldn't be so profitable. When governments manipulate interest rates and make money free, every time in history that's happened, including the great land rush in the Midwest, where the biggest bubble burst in U.S. history in real estate was Chicago in the 1830s, because the government gave away free land and then financed it with cheap money and created a bubble. When you make people will abuse it, speculate, you get bubbles, and then they burst.
It seems as though there's really almost two statements here. If you had to sum up 2015, firstly, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, particularly with regard to financial assets. But then on the other hand, there isn't going to be a lot of places to go, that the next bubble might just be holding cash.
And there's nothing wrong with sitting on cash while everything goes down, because it's not true you don't get a return on that cash. You get a return in direct proportion to how much everything else falls, because the cash keeps its value, everything else falls. So you can buy gold, you can buy real estate, you can buy great companies down the road. It's, you know, 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar. That's how you make a fortune in a deflationary downturn. You don't make it through diversification and asset allocation, because that doesn't, it's the one time in a lifetime that diversification doesn't work, because as we talked earlier, everything goes down.
But couldn't you just make the case, though, for those who really don't have too much choice with diversification? Because there are a lot of people listening to our voices today that are forced to hold, you know, maybe 401ks, but they find themselves in that position. You know, you could always allocate a large portion, if it's a possibility, into something like UUP.
UUP is the ETF that tracks the U.S. dollar. Doesn't do it perfectly, but it's the best option. You know, but also if you're in a 401k plan and, you know, you got large cap stocks, small cap stocks, high yield bonds, emerging markets, and low yield bonds, safe bonds, take the safest, shortest term, most government-like bonds and put your allocation there. And if you can be in UUP, the dollar has been the safe haven thus far every time we've had a crisis, or be in a money market, the closest to cash you can get, because that's the one thing that won't go down.
Very good. Harry Dent, please tell people more about the services you provide and how they can find out more about them on the web, please.
Go to harrydent.com and you can sign up for our free newsletter. Actually, we changed it to Economy and Markets. You just go there, put in your website, and you're done. You get on our newsletter. It comes out 6 days a week. It's great content, and it just lets people get to know us better. Because like you say, we have a very different view than most people. So we like to educate people, and people can just be on that free newsletter until they decide to do something else with us.
As always, I point out that competing viewpoints tend to lead to, you know, I think a better overview of what's headed in the market. So you just can't put on the blinders. These markets are a little bit more sophisticated than that. All right, Harry Dent Jr., we want to thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chris.